This is News in No Time at Gordon. On today's roundtable, can we talk candidly about race and a woman sues a doctor over comments about her weight? Joining us from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. is Republican strategist Tara Settmeyer. Also with us from Nashville, Tennessee at Spotland Productions, Jeff Obafemi-Carr. He's host of the radio program Freestyle in Nashville. And George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service, joins us today from Maryland. All right, folks, I wanted to talk briefly about, not specifically about this incident, but what it raises about where we are again in our country. Baseball fans know that the Los Angeles Dodgers have had some internal controversy and strife between two of their key players, Milton Bradley, who is an African-American outfielder there, and Jeff Kent, who is a white second baseman, have been going back and forth in the press, spurred on by comments of Bradley and talking about one of the team leaders, Kent. I should note that this is a direct quote again from Milton Bradley. The problem here is that he, being Kent, doesn't know how to deal with African Americans. Bradley then went on to say, white people never want to see race in anything. There's race involved in everything. There's race involved in baseball. And his suggestion was Jeff Kent was using off-color language, off-color jokes, and just didn't really know how to deal with the African-American players on that ball club. George Curry, this is something, quite frankly, that we still wonder about. Do we know, A, how to deal with each other, and can we talk candidly about race in this country?
Well, I think, those are good questions, Ed, but I think this is probably a poor example to use to start this conversation, simply because you have two personalities here who are difficult to be kind about it. And so they had that kind of problem already. And then the issue of whether somebody actually ran fast enough to try to score, I mean, that was a separate issue. The problem here is it's not clear to me that race was an issue here based on what we know right now. And the problem you have when you have these other issues, then you overlay it with race, is that you run the risk of crying wolf, or in this case, racism, when it doesn't exist. And then when a legitimate case has come along, people tend to discount it. That is always a problem there.
All right, let's concede that you have two hot-headed baseball players, both with idiosyncrasies that teammates would suggest are a little off. But Milton Bradley went on to say, and you hear a lot of African-American athletes suggest this, that, hey, the white reporters don't get me. They don't always report the things I do in the way they're supposed to, or at least I give them off. Jeff Obafemi-Carr, this is a complaint, quite frankly, beyond a hot-headed baseball player, that we hear from African Americans oft times behind closed doors, even those in the workforce, that there's the joke that if a bunch of us gather, there's a riot breaking out in the minds of African Americans if you're gathered in a workplace more than two of you.
Yeah, indeed. And I think and I will say that there are plenty of occasions that I've been called on to work with people in entertainment and also at professional athletes and assisting in a lot of ways in coaching and that kind of thing. Not coaching physically, but coaching in terms of speaking and that kind of thing and dealing with the media. And that's one of the biggest things that clients that I have say. They say, well, man, I'm sitting in a room and these reporters are all over me. And I'm not expected to say anything political. And the minute that we get into something that deals with something political, then I'm kind of vilified. And I think that race is a factor in the relations that we have in the workplace and the interpersonal relationships we have in America. It's still a shadow that's over us right now. I'm going to agree with George and say that sometimes we can have to be careful of that and crying wolf because we do miss out on legitimate opportunities. But on the other hand, I will say we don't know, because most of this has been in the clubhouse, just what's been going on. There could have been buttons that have been pushed here between these two for a long time.
Yeah, and I'm sure that's the case, and we'll concede that. But we just really wanted to, in spite of George's thought that this might not have been the best example, use this as a jumping off point. Tara Settmeyer, the same can be said, quite frankly, I've heard it in the annals of, or in the corridors, I should say, of Washington, D.C., whether or not we as a people, blacks, whites, Asians, climb deep enough into each other's cultures to really understand. Do we have, the want and the patience to do so?
I think so, and I think there is a legitimate argument here to be had about whether crying wolf or pulling the race card too often desensitizes us to legitimate racial conflicts. I actually do agree with George that there probably could have been other examples, because when you're in a competitive environment like professional sports, egos and personalities sometimes can take over, as opposed to necessarily a racial issue. But as far as in Congress and in politics, sure, race is an issue that is that it will forever be in existence. We cannot deny it. It plays it's a significant factor in how we interact with one another. And oftentimes here, I think that people tiptoe around racial issues because they're afraid of being labeled a racist, and there's a double standard.
Let me add in on that and say that on one hand, I see it's not legitimate when we talk about racism and the ism of it. But on another hand, it is legitimate because it deals with interpersonal relationships. And that's where race comes out a lot. And if the comment was not he's a racist, if the comment was he doesn't know how to deal with African-Americans, what if that is true? What if there are some racial jokes that are taken sometimes that are going on? These are the interpersonal relationships that lead to systemic racism and ignorance and us not being able to communicate with one another.
And I think his own comments was that they all joke about it. I mean, he had said that goes on in the room in that ball club. The problem I have with this is, you know, look, a lot of these athletes have white agents, have white business partners, have white wives. Let's go down the list, and they get along well in that environment. And then when something that does not go their way, they're quick to say racism. People like Charles Barkley is an example of them. That's what they do. And so I think it's too convenient. It really is too convenient because it doesn't explain everything.
Kara, you were going to say?
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And given the examples that George gave, and as a person who follows competitive sports closely, he's right about that. And I am very leery of athletes who are quick to throw the race card when things don't go their way, which is why it's concerning, because it's interesting because we want to teach diversity and sensitivity, but yet when is it okay to joke and say off the cuff remarks? We can't have it both ways. We can't be hypersensitive and put everyone through diversity training from the military on down, but it's okay in a sports environment or when you're just joking around in an office. It sends conflicting messages. So we have to be careful about when the race card is thrown.
Well, but I also think, and we'll move on to another topic, the point that was missed, I think, and that we tended to harp on the idea of whether it was racist or not, is whether or not we do, quote, get each other, to use Milton Bradley's words. And I often think that we don't, and we don't like to talk about that we don't get each other. You know, the idea that whites want to watch Friends and blacks want to watch Girlfriends, and they're two different sensibilities, and you don't always get the cross humor and the like, and we don't like to talk about that there are certain differences. And it's interesting to see, even with a group of black folks, that we steered toward one thing and not the other, but that's for another day. We'll take a look at the bail that was set for a 12-year-old boy in Boston who was being charged with firing a gun in public. The district attorney's office had asked for $5,000 bail for this young man. The judge, Paul D. Lewis, said he has lost his patience with youth violence after 23 years on the juvenile bench and set bail for $250,000.
I think it's wrong for a judge to use his power on the bench to levy something personal like that to someone. Paul Lewis said that he's lost patience after 23 years of being on the bench with youth violence. Well, I'll be honest, I've lost patience with white supremacy after 38 years of being a black man in America, but that doesn't make it okay for me to go nuts on a person the next time I perceive them to be prejudiced. I think that a 12-year-old at that age doesn't understand the ramifications of what they do. And we live in a different kind of culture now. We live in a culture that says through the music and through the media and through the films that it's okay to play with guns. It's okay to be violent. We live in a culture that's a war culture. And I don't think he understood the ramifications. And I think this is the wrong way to make a statement.
All right, let me speak for the judge and then pick up on your point here. I suspect with the judge's further comments where he says these kids don't take responsibility for anything. They're fearless. It's out of control. It's beyond out of control. He would say to you that a 12-year-old does know better than firing a gun in public.
Well, the problem in this case, Ed, is you got somebody that who's, according to his attorney, is developmentally disabled, okay? That's the first thing. Mm-hmm. Secondly, this is an overreaction. The district attorney recommended a $5,000 bail. This is a person who has not had any prior trouble, and they shot the gun apparently in the air and injured nobody. So to have all of your frustration about the juvenile justice system come out in a kid with no prior record and has other kinds of problems, I think is an overreaction.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you think that these kids continue to engage in behavior like this? It's because an example isn't set. We continue to make excuses. Now, I'm not going to say that the $250,000 bond in this case wasn't excessive. I think that's a little excessive. But at the same time, we need to stop making excuses. Yes, there are things prevalent in our culture, in our music, and with absentee parents. I mean, we can go. There's a litany of things that contribute to this behavior. However, at some point, where is the responsibility? And whether this child is developmentally disabled or not, we don't know that for sure yet. That's a quick excuse to be used. If that's the case, fine. But you know, he's one of thousands, tens and thousands of kids who are engaged in gun violence across this country, and who, if you get a slap on the wrist, the chances are this kid will get involved in it again. So where do we draw the line? We need to start taking responsibility in our communities. And, you know, should a judge take his frustrations out on one child? No, but I think his point is well taken. So where do we draw the line?
Yeah, I agree with Tara that there needs to be some personal responsibility, and there doesn't need to be any excuses. I also believe in cause and effect, and I think that we have to deal with what we inspect and not what we expect. So we expect that these personal responsibility issues are going to be taken care of, but what we have to look at is the fact that, yes, if these kids are fearless, where did they get the fearlessness from? If these kids are callous, where did they get the callousness from? They're not born with this. This is learned behavior, that it's okay to do this kind of thing. What can we do to address the things that make it okay for a kid to stand on a corner, whether he's disabled mentally or not, and shoot a gun in the air? I think it's more systemic than that.
Well, and I think it's more complicated than that, too. I think a lot of things, mm-hmm, with these video games, for example, you see how violent they are, even against cops, the infusion of drugs in our community, the violence that, quite frankly, was not there when I grew up. You know, when I got in a fight back in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, the worst thing you do is get knocked out and come back tomorrow. Well, now right. You're talking about guns. You have a totally different culture, and I'm not so sure you can say it's all just the kids, and there are examples of them not doing that.
Well, where are we taking responsibility as a people, especially our elected black leaders? I don't see anyone. If you want to start somewhere, let's start with music and music videos and gangster rap and the trash that's on the radio these days that continues to pour into our communities unfettered. And I don't see any congressional black caucus members lodging protests against the record companies or 50 Cent and everyone else who portrays these images. And his whole career was built on the fact that he was shot, survived it, and now he's, you know, back on the street and worth $100 million.
Well, we should note, though, to be fair, example. That there have been CBC members as well as Essence magazine last year that have taken this on. What we have not seen is a groundswell of folks who suggest that they're going to really stand up and say that they're tired of this. There have been individuals that have attempted to sway people to pull back the reins on what we're seeing. But it goes back to the idea of, do we have to admit that it is now time to say, as a community, we've crossed the line here, and as leadership oftentimes has to do, push the mass back?
I think so, but we also have to see where the actual controls are. We go out and we buy a bunch of CDs and we mash over them with steamrollers, and we go and we put labels on the CDs, and we attack the rappers and we attack the musicians and we attack the people who are doing the videos, etc. Well, we don't attack where it really goes, and that goes to the heart of the record companies, the executives, the network executives who put these videos on TV, the people who will hire and sign a 50 Cent as opposed to a rapper who is saying something conscious about uplifting the community, and of course the media conglomerates who own thousands of radio stations and decide with relationships they have.
Yeah,
with
but
these
I've said this before, Jeff. We as a community
air.
Are afraid to stand up and say, "Look, enough's enough." Some of these images have crossed the line. You've gone
Absolutely.
Too far for fear of being called a Tom.
And what I seem to remember several years ago, C. Dolores Tucker, who is a very well-respected woman of color in the community, who went out there and said, enough is enough. She took it to the record executives and the companies who were continuing to sign these rappers and put out these videos, and she was vilified. And I also don't recall BET not refusing to air these videos, and or I don't see BET running conscious rappers all the time. They're complicit in this as well, and that's a black... I mean, that's the premier.
Well, they were at the
Viacom.
Time. They're no longer.
It's
but again, George Curry, let's talk about what the reality is and the responsibility of a BET or any network, quite frankly.
Okay.
The reality there is they're out to make money.
Is
it not up to the parents to make the kids turn it off versus it not being there?
They're out to make the money, and let's not forget that 72% of all rappers are bought by whites, not African Americans. I think the real larger issue that's part of this debate is that we have, and we must admit this, we have glamorized thuggery. And, you know, and now that's not to dismiss all rap, because not all of it is bad, but we have glamorized thug life. And that's something that has not been traditional with us. Even when you're going to get your butt whipped during the civil rights movement and during the marches, people were dressed up in ties and dresses because they had dignity. And we kind of have turned our heads, and I agree with that, to some extent, and saying, it's all right to be a thug. No, it's not all right. And that's part of the larger problem.
So then, going back to the point of the issue of the excessive bail, do you applaud this judge at some point in saying, well, here's one person who's saying and making a loud statement, he certainly knew this was going to be looked at, enough's enough.
But not, that's a different way, though. It's the wrong case. It's the wrong case. The larger issue here will not be solved by what one judge says from a bench on a kid who's never had any trouble before. The larger question is that we have to address, and to go back to your earlier question, yes, the families have responsibility. Who's paying for this music? Who's allowing it in their homes? And that is our responsibility.
Yeah, and it's in a situation like that, you don't want to ruin one child's life. At this point, you want to be punitive, but to the point where are they going to learn so they don't repeat this type of behavior? And setting a $250,000 bail, like I said, is also excessive. I mean, there needs to be consistency as well. One judge with one child is not going to change the system. This needs to be consistent. And also, this child, I agree with George, he shot the gun, he didn't shoot it at anyone, and then he handed the gun to the police. And so... you know, as opposed to him killing someone, you know, if he would have shot someone and killed someone and taken a life, then maybe this would have been appropriate. But not to excuse him playing with guns, but in this case, I think it's a little excessive.
Got to stop it there. But if he were standing on your street corner by your house, Tara, I'd call you back and see if you had the same thought. Tara,
well,
George,
not $250,000.
And Jeff, thanks so much. All right. Coming up, Barbershop, the TV show. We'll talk to the show's writer and director, John Ridley.